And of course, it's our final hour here with Robert Morningstar. We're going to take your phone calls, continue chatting with him more about Stanley Kubrick and what his plan was next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Robert Morningstar with us. Robert, back to Stanley Kubrick for again. I had a chance during the top of the hour to look at the face of the alien in the shadow. It is kind of eerie, isn't it?
It was amazing to see it. And I realized, you know, that the 2001 A Space Odyssey actually was intended to act upon us subliminally. To finish the story about the monolith, I said it taught some monkeys to tie knots. It taught other monkeys how to pick up sticks and start drawing on the ground, the beginning of writing. And it taught that famous monkey, Moonwatcher, how to pick up that bone and start smashing animals. And that produced a food supply and also a weapon. It was a double-edged sword. It produced an instrument, the first tool that a primitive man could use as a weapon to kill animals and start to eat meat. But it also provided the weapon that drove the other monkeys from the waterhole, you see? So in a sense, it also seeded war. The alien planted the instruments of war. Now, that was supposed to happen maybe 1.5 million years before our time, you see? The first part, the monkey part.
Yep.
Then there's the monolith that's found in Clavius on the moon. And that's the astronauts surrounding that monolith is an analog of the monkeys surrounding the first monolith, you see? So when that beam that, you know, their ears split because they hear this sound, that beam was tracked by all the space satellites we had, that it was beamed to Jupiter, and that's the way they wound up going there. So what did 2001 teach us? An alien presence that's been interacting with human evolution for millions of years, an alien presence on the moon that has left pointers for us to directional signals like traffic signs go this way. The third one reveals time travel, wormholes, and the recycling of souls, because David Bowman, the astronaut who dies in that very strange telling of the story at the end where he winds up in that room with all the French art, that room had been prepared intentionally for someone from Earth to arrive. They'd been waiting for millions of years. When he dies, he is sipped back to Earth, and he's the star child that's being birthed. And the movie...
And the process just goes over and over again.
Right, except the movie doesn't tell you what happened. Nuclear war was breaking out on Earth at the very moment that the star child was born. Wow. And the star child, by an act of will, teleports himself to Earth orbit. And he appears on all the radar screens that are tracking all the ICBMs that are going to destroy Russia and the United States. And in one flash of light, the star child detonates all of the nuclear weapons in outer space, creating a false dawn that was seen by half the world. And then it ends with the most beautiful line, because each time when the monkey learned how to use the weapon, he looked at the moon and he said he knew that he'd discovered something. He didn't know what it was for, but he would think of something. And that's the very last line of the star child. He's just being born, and he said he arrived, and he didn't know what he would do with this new power, but he would think of something. So Stanley Kubrick, that movie changed my life. Let me tell you that when I had this epiphany, I had an experience. I had been in Army ROTC the year before. I switched over after the Apollo 8 orbit of the moon. I was psyched that I wanted to be an astronaut, so I joined the U.S. Air Force ROTC program, and I was getting involved in that. I see this movie, and at the end of it, this thing happens, and I said, I want to go there. And this voice said, yes, Robert, you can go there, but you can't get there in a rocket. And that was a turning point in my life, because what it was telling me is we can get there through the human mind. And that's where I pursued even more fervently the field of parapsychology. And
we just let's go to the phones for you, Robert. Okay, they're lining up for you. We'll go to Harriet first in San Diego. Welcome to the program. Hi, Harriet. Good morning.
Thank you, George. Hi, it's really good to talk to you again. It's been a long time. This is just fascinating that Robert's talking about. It's a breakthrough, as a matter of fact. I'm sure he would agree with that. It just comes to my mind, and, you know, we'd do well to study these things to help us to go these places in our minds. But I could never quite understand why, through all the years of, you know, the last 50, 60 years, everything is so cloaked with secrecy, half-truths, outright lies. Is that to maintain control of information? Do you have any theories on that, Robert?
Yes, it's precisely that. It's to control information and control the temperament, the psychological temperament of the country. They did a study in 1967. It was commissioned by NASA to the Brookings Institution to determine what should be done if we encountered alien intelligence or life in outer space. And they found, or they concluded, they didn't find anything. They concluded that if we were to find intelligent life or life that was more intelligent than we are, that it would pose a threat to world systems, including world religions, economy, and science, and that it would disturb the equilibrium of the psychological equilibrium of the planet primarily, and that the people most affected by this discovery or that revelation would not be the common people who would be able to make adjustments. You know, people who believe in religions, they might, you know, we just make an adjustment. But the people who would be most disheartened would be scientists themselves. Scientists, doctors, and engineers are labeled as the people who would be most disrupted mentally by the revelation of a higher intelligence with a superior technology, a technology that could be hundreds of years ahead of us, and that they would be so depressed and despondent that they might not even get out of bed to go to work the next morning, realizing the futility of having to try to catch up with something like the technology of UFO. And also the disruption of religion and belief systems. We have to understand that religion is one of the glues of society. And the disruption of religion results in chaos and the disruption of society. So those were their main concerns, psychological impact. So they said, if you find anything, don't tell anybody about it. But of course, we found something, and it can't be hidden. And so around 1966 or 67, it was revealed by Frank Edwards, who wrote Flying Saucer Serious Business.
And a great reporter at the time.
Oh, fantastic. I saw him live on the Alan Burke Show, which was on Channel 5, WNEW in New York, and I've never forgotten him. And he said in 1966 that the CIA had seven-year programs, 49 years, and that every 7 years they would be implementing a plan to reveal the UFO presence and an extraterrestrial intelligence very gradually in stages to reduce the culture shock and the psychological shock to the world, but primarily to Americans. And listen to this. He said that this would be done through movies. Movies such as we had never seen before, involving technologies that we couldn't even conceive in 1966, but that these movies would reveal to the American public UFOs, the reality of UFOs, the alien presence on this planet, and that it would take 7 times 7 years. Now listen, that was 1966. He said, all of the movies that we've seen thus far have been monsters from outer space, like the 1950s genres. In the 1960s, the movies started to change a little, and the one that comes most readily to mind was Robinson Crusoe on Mars, where an American astronaut goes to Mars and encounters a mining operation.
Was that with Dennis Quaid?
I'm not sure it was Dennis Quaid. No, it was another actor.
Okay.
His name was Paul something. I remember vividly. But he finds a man Friday, and he frees him from the neck shackle or the necklace that binds the men as a slave. And they escape the aliens and the mining operation. And it's a very intelligent, well-told story. And it's revealing what many people believe the aliens are doing here on Earth, mining. One theory
Paul Mantee, by the way.
Mining for gold. But another one I've heard is that the Greys are here for magnets. Dig it. Magnets. Natural.
Why?
Natural magnets, because their technology is based on magnetism. And so that's the resource that the Greys really want.
It's
so
that's ironic, the by the way, it was Paul Mantee.
Of information and control of public opinion.
It was Paul Mantee who was that actor, and he just died this year.
Oh, my. He was really a good actor.
Yeah, he sure was. And by the way, Billy Saul Estes died this year, too. He died in May.
Oh, I had heard that he was alive, and I was hoping that one day I'd get to talk to him. You know, I got to talk to Joseph Kennedy's lawyer just by chance. I have a roommate, and she came and she said, you know, what are you into? You know, what do you do? And it was November, and I said, well, right now I'm getting ready for the JFK 50th anniversary. And she says, you like Kennedy? I said, I love John F. Kennedy as if he was my older brother. And she says, well, you know, I know his lawyer. I said, what? You know John Kennedy's lawyer? Yes, he lives in Boston. I said, my God, he must be very old. She says, yeah, he's 99. And my friend, she cooks for him. I said, my God, I would really love to speak to this man. And she says, I'll give you his number. I'm in shock, you know. So she gives me this number of a man named Ben. So I call him up. Hello, Ben. My name is Robert Morningstar. I met Robert Kennedy in the flesh, and I saw John F. Kennedy. And I said, I'm a friend of the Kennedys, you know. I'm a longtime admirer, and I've been told that you are John F. Kennedy's lawyer. And he says, well, no, I'm not John's lawyer. I'm Joe's lawyer.
Wow.
I said, what?
Huh.
I'm his father's lawyer, he says to me. I said, oh, my God, you're Joseph Kennedy's lawyer? He says, yes, I am. And I said, oh, then you must have known Jack. And during that period, the congressional run, his first run for Congress.
His first run, yeah.
And he says, yes, as a matter of fact, I was going to run for Congress. And one day, Joe walked into my office and he said to me, Ben, I've heard that you're planning to run for Congress. He says, yes, Joe, I am. And Joe said to me, well, Ben, I don't think you're going to do that. And I said, why? And he says, well, because my son Jack wants to run for Congress. And then he said, he left me flabbergasted. And I said, well, Joe, Ben, he actually asked you to withdraw from your candidacy from running? He said, yes, he did.
And he did.
And did you? And he said, yes, I did. And I said, well, Ben, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, because if you hadn't done that, you would have changed the entire history of the United States.
That's true.
And so he then told me.
One move.
Unbelievable. He said to me very, you know, an aside, he said, well, I decided then to run for Secretary of State in Massachusetts that year. And he ran for Congress and I ran for Secretary of State. But I lost it. I lost the election because the Republicans. And I said, okay, Joe, say it. The Republicans rigged the election, right? He goes, yes, they did.
Oh,
and then he proudly said to me, but I won the District of Cambridge and Jack lost it.
I love it. Let's go to Ken in Morton, Illinois. Go ahead, Kenny. You're on with us.
Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Is there a publication or a listing of all the people who were murdered in the connection with the murder of President Kennedy?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've read one of the best of them, and that's by Jim Mars. And it's on the Internet. If you type in Jim Mars and I think Dead Witnesses, JFK assassination, Dead Witnesses, you'll get a long list of them. And it's an important question you ask, because This is one of the avenues of investigation that I pursued. I'd heard about all of these people being killed and meeting untimely deaths. And I said to myself, well, you know, what the really important thing is not just knowing their names, but let's find out what they were talking about. So I began to investigate the people that were killed. And invariably, the majority were people who had knowledge of Jack Ruby's relationship with J.D. Tippit, or Jack Ruby's relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald. And two of them were reporters who went with the police to Jack Ruby's apartment the night that he killed Oswald. And they saw something in his apartment that made them undesirables. And one was killed by a karate chop to the throat while he was taking a shower, and the other one died a quote-unquote accidental death in the locker room of the Los Angeles Police Department when a Los Angeles policeman claimed to have dropped his gun on the floor. The gun discharged and killed this reporter.
Oh, my God. We didn't have videotapes then, did we?
No. But, you know, the Robert Kennedy assassination in Los Angeles is another one of these, the series, the KKK killings. There was Kennedy, King, and Kennedy.
That's right.
And they're all interrelated. And I'll tell you this. In 1963, the FBI recorded a conversation between William Somerset and Joseph Miltier, who was the number three man in the Ku Klux Klan. And in that conversation, Miltier explicitly stated that they were stalking John F. Kennedy, and they were planning to use a high-powered rifle from a high office building, and that they were going to arrest a patsy within hours of the assassination or the killing and pin it on the patsy. Furthermore, he said they had many plans to kill President Kennedy, and one of them was to put a shooter in a hotel across from the White House waiting for him to come out on the porch, on the veranda, and that they would try to nail him from there. And right there, you have the plan that was used to assassinate Martin Luther King.
There it is. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to come back in just a moment here and take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM, and I'll tell you what's in store on our next program as well. And if you need to email me, well, that's very simple, george@coasttocoastam.com, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram by going to our far right-hand corner at coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, split show for you. For the first couple hours, we're going to talk about, of course, how people all over the world are waking up to the scary potential of abuse from government. And then later on in the show, We Don't Die, A Skeptic's Discovery of Life After Death. Two topics you don't want to miss. When we come back in a moment with Robert Morningstar, we'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. We'll get to your calls in a second here with Robert Morningstar. Robert, of everything you've looked at, investigated, discussed, is there one topic that still baffles you the most?
There are a lot of topics that baffle me, and I keep trying to get to the root of it. One thing that baffles me that I wanted to talk on the show tonight and is the music of the moon. I have the transcript of the voice transcript recorders, the black box and airliners that we speak about after airline crashes. That was developed by NASA, and it was put into the Apollo 10 capsule without the knowledge of the astronauts, because we were afraid that we might lose the astronauts through some mishap on the far side of the moon, which was called the dark side then. Mm-hmm. They were worried that if something happened and we lost the crew, we'd never know what happened. So they rigged a looped tape recorder that would record for the period of time when they'd be on the out of communication. That was the main thing. The moon is in the way of radio communication. Right. So there was a dead zone. and we wouldn't be able to communicate with them until they came around again. So they wanted to be sure that we knew what was going on the far side when they were out of radio contact. And so they put this recorder, the first black box, I believe, in the Apollo spacecraft. So when they went on the far side of the moon, Gene Cernan was taken by the sounds that they heard. They weren't supposed to hear anything. There's not supposed to be any radio transmissions on the far side of the moon. But he heard something that to him was music. And I have the transcript here, and I just wanted to read you a few of those few phrases where they talk about this, the music that they're hearing.
Okay, go ahead.
A weird outer spacey music, he calls it. And it actually shows that the cover-up of whatever this presence is on the moon didn't start down here on the ground. It started in the space capsule. The astronauts decided on their own conference that the music they heard was too weird to report to Houston, and that when they got back to Earth, they shouldn't tell anybody because nobody would believe them, and they might not fly again, you know? They might get there.
So we picked up on it after they listened to the black
box. Well, actually, the transcript was released about 5 years ago, I believe. That's when I came across it, and I started reading it. I'm like, oh, my God. And I'd heard this story once before, but in relationship to Apollo 11, in that I know an old-time life reporter who was very involved in the JFK assassination, and he was at a party at George Plimpton's house here in New York in the 1970s after Armstrong and Aldrin had landed, and I believe it was Aldrin who was the guest of honor at George Plimpton's house, and he was being lionized, you know, the hero, and of course he is. But my friend had the audacity to ask him a question which put off a lot of people. He said, Colonel Aldrin, was there any time during your trip to the moon when you felt scared? And everybody was like, oh, my God, how dare he? How can he say that he would be scared? And Aldrin himself was taken aback a little bit by it. But then he said, well, you know, yes, there was. When we were on the dark side, on the far side of the moon, I heard some sounds coming over the radio that I couldn't explain. And that was the moment.
That was it.
That was Aldrin. But this, what I'm talking about, is Gene Cernan, Tom mm-hmm. Stafford, and John Young on the Apollo 10 mission, the previous mission, which went to the moon, orbited the moon, detached the lunar lander, and tested it. They descended to within 8 miles of the surface of the moon, then aborted the landing, went back up, coupled up, and came back. Proof that they could do it. That was what the purpose of the Apollo
mission was. And it was a successful mission, wasn't it?
And it was a very, as were all of them. Apollo 8 was a transcendental. The reading of the Bible, the Genesis over the moon. But more importantly for me was that Frank Borman, when they entered orbit, beamed back. Everything was live then. We were all in on it, right? So Frank Borman radioed back to Capcom, and he said, Houston, be advised that there is a Santa Claus. And I'll tell you, George, I knew what he was talking about. Santa Claus was the code word for UFOs. So, Houston, be advised that there is a Santa Claus, and the American people do know it now.
Now, this music...
The music, I can read you the excerpt. It's very short, but it shows you that Gene Cernan, above all others, was the one that was really taken by it. So here it is. It's just before they go on the other side, and it says they're getting ready for this dark side trip. And I'll start with the lunar module pilot, which is Gene Cernan. And he says, we need another mark at 10 minutes. And then he goes, God dang it. Houston, I'm putting you on omnis. I guess it's omnidirectional transceivers. And he says, Roger, Gene. Omni, I just had it. I just had a blank because the radio gets disrupted. And then we get, Houston, we've got you on Omnis. You hear music, Tom? That crazy whistling? I can hear it. That's Commander Tom Stafford. That's really weird, Commander Stafford says. It is. Capcom says, Snoop, Houston, as you go over the hill, you're looking good. We're all go here. Roger, Charlie. And we'll hit proceed in at 12 minutes. Everything is looking good. We're going to ignore the out-of-plane correction at CSI. Over. Okay, we go next to the next reference of the moon. Okay, and this is 5 minutes later. And again, it's Gene Cernan. In Houston, we've got you on... he didn't go to the next. Okay, at 5 minutes later, it starts like this... How in the hell did we miss that? They're talking about torquing up the platform. We had to have someone on our side that time. Yes. Listen to that eerie music. Listen to the eerie music, says Cernan. You ready? Stafford is trying to ignore him. See? He says, like, listen to eerie music. You ready? Yes, I need to go into 4-1. Yes, okay, plus 4.5.30 plus 0.6. Okay, go ahead. You ready for auto maneuver? Yes. Okay, skip. Another few minutes. Again. John, do you know where we're going to burn now? And he gives the fuel burn. Roger, those numbers again, Gino, or what? I'll put mine on, Tom. I'll tell you, John. That music is really weird. And then the command module pilot, John Young, says, think we're going to get it on the front side? I know it. You composed something, huh? I don't know, man. No one will believe us. Okay, Tom, we're set until 35 minutes, 35 seconds, and we're at 4 minutes, 35 seconds from the burn. Okay, next one. All right. They're back together.
Let's go one more, and then let's wrap up with some calls.
Okay, he says, this is 2 hours later, and Gene Cernan says, that music even sounds outer spacey, doesn't it? You hear that? That whistling sound? And then Stafford says, yes. Woo! Say your, I guess he was going to say your prayers. Did you hear that whistling sound, too? Yes. Sounds like, outer space type music. I wonder what it is. Hey, Tom, is your installation all burnt off here? It goes on like that. But there's obviously some radio transmission, something going on dark side, far side of the moon, and it's not noise. Because when you have radio interference, you say, hey, do you hear that noise? You don't say, hey, do you hear that music, outer spacey music, really weird, you know? So... they later talk about it one more time and say, hey, let's not tell Houston.
That's great stuff. Let's go to Jacob now in Seward, Alaska. Jacob, go ahead. Thanks for holding so long.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Morningstar.
Robert Morningstar. Professor sometimes.
Oh, okay. This is a very exciting deal for me because I've looked at Mona Lisa on the Moon for quite a while. I was just wondering... if you noticed that there was a in the video, you know, you can look at it on YouTube, but in the video there was a yellow paper with a different sort of language on it, and I was just wondering if you tried to match that language to anything that's known.
No, I have missed that. I'm very intrigued by it because one of the skills I do have is that I read ancient and modern Chinese, and this body is intriguing to me for another reason. On the way to the moon, Apollo 11 received a message from Capcom, and they said to them, listen, when you're on the moon there, we want you to look around for this Chinese princess. Her name is Chang O, and the Chinese say they have a legend that she was abducted by a tall gray rabbit that took her to the moon.
Well, how about that?
How about that? Yeah. And this is an ancient Chinese legend of a Chinese princess that was abducted by a tall gray rabbit and took her to the moon. we see the man on the moon, you know, the face of the man on the moon, we call it that. The Chinese say the rabbit on the moon because they see the shape of a rabbit. Now, you know, I'm a mythologist, and I believe that, as Joseph Campbell said in Myth to Live By, a little boy was asked in third grade, does anybody know what a myth is? And one little boy raised his hand, Johnny, and the teacher said, Johnny, you know what a myth is? He says, yes, a myth is something that's true on the inside but not on the outside. I thought that's the most brilliant expression of a myth. It's something that creates and carries a kernel of truth that is easily transmittable from generation to generation. And if you want to hear more about this, you might read Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, who does an analysis of legends, myths, and the embedding within the legends of special numbers, sacred numbers, the myth facilitates the transmission and propagation of that secret knowledge. So I will look at that again. I will look for that parchment, and I will look for that writing because I'm intrigued by writing. Arabic is supposed to have been taught to the Arabs by angels, and the first writing of the Chinese is called the Script of Heaven. And as I mentioned earlier about the Stanley Kubrick movie, the monolith, they took one of the monkeys and took a stick and started to write. But here's the interesting thing about that Kubrick, the book. The older monkeys who were not able to make the adjustment to this new knowledge, they suffered violent reactions and some of them died. For example, the old ones, when some of them were being taught how to tie knots, they couldn't handle it. They had heart attacks. And the young monkeys who were able to adapt, succeeded, acquired the skill, and then began the evolution of man. I will look for that parchment. Now you've got me interested. And this is what I call cross-pollination of information. When we share information freely, as we are doing, each of us has something to contribute to the other. And you have contributed something to me by sparking my curiosity, and God only knows what we'll find, what I'll find when I look at that parchment. I will look for it. And thank you very much for the question.
Well, let's go to Julie in Idaho now. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi, you guys. Robert, I've got a lot to say really quick. Can I just get through everything and then you comment?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, I was 40 years ago. Anyway, I was told they were going to take and show me things. So anyway, during the night, I got taken and I was showing three different things. And then I remember coming back fast over the dark hills, and then suddenly I'm in my bed and the stars and everything. I go, wow, you know, this is pretty cool. But art, I was an artist, and apparently someone thought they could, you know, because of my art ability and everything. So anyway, it was 40 years, past, present, future. I mean, I've got hieroglyphs. I had to learn hieroglyphs. I've got the past and then on up, and I've got people, stars. They must be star people because they have insignias on their the type of people. But the thing is that whatever this was, and whether it's frequency or whatever, it was moving. I would really fall in love with some of these, and suddenly they were there, and there would be different ones, you know. So there is so many of those, and there's star configurations on that. Geez, I'd like you to come and look at them.
Let's get his reaction, Julie, because we only got a minute left. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, we have here is another instance of the stimulation of artistic skills of an artist, inspiration. I know a lot of people who are artists who had UFO experience and their skills. You know, you were playing Jimi Hendrix before?
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix in Third Stone from the Sun reveals that he thinks he's an alien. You listen closely to the lyrics. But Jimi Hendrix had an experience with a UFO that he and Curtis Mayfield claim saved their lives in a blizzard They were driving on the New York State Thruway way upstate in a giant blizzard, and they went off the road and got stuck in a giant mound of snowpack, and they couldn't move. And they thought they were going to die. And the story is that a UFO appeared in front of, above the car. An alien came out, walked over to the window. Jimi Hendrix looked through the window. And that, and Mayfield said that Jimi Hendrix was having a telepathic communication with the alien, and that the alien went back to his ship and then zipped out and melted all the snow enough for them to get back on the road. Another one was John Lennon, and he had two experiences with UFOs, including a direct alien experience in the Dakota. The building in which he lived, where he was shot, he woke up one morning. He was awakened by something. And he looked in his bedroom, and he saw light coming in under the door. And he said, man, somebody must be filming a movie in my hallway.
Little did he know. Robert, thanks for being on the program. Very great stuff that you brought to us. For Dan Galante, Trish Pepe, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.